Coming up on Boston Public Radio, a lot of mayor talk. We've invited each of the candidates to call in to make a final pitch. But we'll start with CNN's John King on whether Americans were involved in the attacks in Kenya, on whether Iran's new leader and our president will shake hands at the UN, and a CNN exclusive, has the president really stopped smoking? Then Kelly Crossley and David Bernstein on all things mayoral, including who will survive today's preliminary and why.
Continuing our introduction of Democrats running for governor, we're joined by Joe Avalon, former surgeon and healthcare executive. Returning to our election theme, Garen Daly tells us about mayors in movies. Can you think of any? Then we'll ask you, does it matter whether Boston, now a majority-minority city, elects a person of color or not? All that's coming up on Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It is, of course, in Boston, Election Day.
I was going to ask you if you voted, and I forgot. You don't live in Boston, nor do I, but
know.
We're both wildly excited.
Don't you wish you did live in Boston
for
today?
One day? Yes, I do. So the Senate is bracing for a budget showdown. The nation girds its loins for Obamacare, and the biggest question of the day is, will President Obama and Iran's new president shake hands at the UN? One thing's for sure, though, Obama's fingers will not have nicotine stains. Joining us to explain that and more is CNN's chief national correspondent. That'd be John King. Hello, John.
Hello. I wish I could vote in Boston today, too.
I bet you
well,
do.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you that, John. You're a Dorchester guy. When was the last mayoral election you were here? Were you ever able to vote here, or did you move out before you were old enough?
I was gone. When I came back and I was old enough, I actually lived when I came back and was working in Boston, I lived in what we call MEFA. I was on the Medford-Somerville line back in those days when I was working for the AP in Boston. So, no, I never got to vote in a Boston mayoral election. I grew up with Kevin White as the mayor, those were crazy days. But this is a big one. You've had a mayor for so long, I think, a wide open field. It's going to be interesting.
You know, John King, before we leave the mayoral thing, I am apoplectic over the projections about turnout when it's the first election in two decades where there's not an incumbent on the ballot. Tell me that the King's siblings and extended family are all voting today, are they?
You know, there's none of them left in Boston.
Is that true?
Amazing? My older brother lives out to the west, and the others all live down on the South Shore. None of them. The last one, my younger sister lived on St. Mark's Road until about 2.5 years ago, and she bought a house in Quincy. They're all out of the city, which is kind of sad. I keep saying I want to come back and buy my parents' old house and restore it. But that would require me to move back. So we'll see how this next mayor does, and maybe I'll move back.
Well, I tell you, if they can get a mayor that really does some dramatic turnaround on the school, they'll be able to keep people in the city and not have everybody fleeing to other places to get better schools.
So here is this morning at about 9:30, the president speaking at the UN. He turned up the heat on the governing body regarding Syria. Here he is.
There must be a strong Security Council resolution to verify that the Assad regime is keeping its commitments. And there must be consequences if they fail to do so. If we cannot agree even on this, then it will show that the United Nations is incapable of enforcing the most basic of international laws.
So, John King, we know that that was Barack Obama. Of course, he was at the UN. The president of Iran is also at the UN today. But what was the significance of this? Why was this such a – why did he do this? Why was he there? What was the big deal about talking about Syria at the UN?
Well, because he needs a resolution. Now that Russia brokered this deal with Syria, they need a resolution to actually, you know, put it in writing, put the deal down in writing through a body that has enforcement powers. And the United Nations has enforcement powers. That's going to be the hard part for the president. Everybody agrees with this, you know, the deal. Okay, great. We've got a deal. But the issue then is, how do you enforce it? What if Syria just walks away? And the president wants language that, you know, implies, or at least, or he would love language that specifically said, military force. I don't think he's going to get that. So he's instead trying to get something that implicitly says there's an enforcement mechanism. And that's going to be the next fight in the Security Council now as you go through, because the Russians say, oh, don't worry, trust Syria. And of course, the White House says, no.
And on the Iranian front, there was this overture that surprised most of us who are amateurs in that world from the new Iranian president. There's a question, will they meet? Will they shake hands? Israel is all up in arms about this overture, saying it's phony. What is going to happen, if anything, between the Iranian president and ours?
Well, if you listen to the president's speech today, it was clear he was backing off. He didn't say this specifically. He's backing off from the idea of a meeting just yet. He says he's hearing very hopeful things, but he needs to see very hopeful things, not just hear very hopeful things. So I think it's becoming less likely, although don't rule it out. Here's the hard one for the administration. Israel thinks that America is being played, essentially, that you're getting great rhetoric out of Iran, but they're not going to deliver, that they are going to say all the right things, but then not do the right things, like allow access to their nuclear facilities, like break down and dismantle some of the operations that use the centrifuges to produce nuclear materials. And so there's a great deal of skepticism, and there's a great deal of skepticism in the United States Congress. So if you're the president of the United States, do you decide, you know what, I'm going to break the rules of diplomacy and look this guy in the eye and size him up myself? Or does that give Iran too much of a public relations coup? It's been almost 35 years since an American president sat down with his Iranian counterpart. And so I would not be surprised if Secretary Kerry has an encounter. It's possible these two walk by each other and the president and President Rouhani shake hands and nod. But even that's part of the gift. And so I think the administration is trying to be careful.
How carefully orchestrated are these things, John King? And I mean this sincerely. It may sound like a joke. Does Rouhani have the ability to say to his staff, hey, find out what exit Barack Obama is going out after he gives his address and get me there so we bump into each other and have a camera ready? Is that, can that happen, or is our president so insulated that can never happen?
Well, it can happen in the sense that there are dinners and receptions and the like where they tend to be in the same room. When you're at the General Assembly, you're there. I remember this was the Mandela inauguration years ago when, Castro was trying to get to shake Al Gore's hand, Fidel Castro back in those days, and he was chasing him down a hall at one point, and Gore was ducking behind staff to get away from him. So it happens. It does happen. And look, we're laughing about this. This is a hard one in the sense that, remember candidate Obama took a lot of grief when he said he'd be willing to sit down in his first year in office with the leaders of Iran, North Korea.
Right.
And his point was, just let's look him in the eye and lay out the deal, and then they don't get the second meeting unless they deliver. That makes a lot of sense to some people. On the other hand, if you're Iran and you've been, the pariah of the world for so long, the big question is, Rouhani is here as the president, but we don't know how long of a leash he has, how long of a leash the mullahs, the ayatollahs, are going to give him to make this deal. Now, there are indications they want a deal, too, because of the punishing economic sanctions. But do they just want to talk about a deal to get sanctions aimed? Are they ready to do the right thing? It's the same idea we're talking about in Syria. People can say they want a deal, and then the hard part is doing the deal. And at what point do you give them the stature, the trophy of a meeting, even a brief encounter with the president of the United States? And it's a tough one. The president in his heart wants to do it. He wants to eyeball this guy and get a gut feeling for it. But it's risky.
Well, you sort of answered my question, John, but I just want to be sure. With this Rouhani guy, the new guy, some people in the United States have been a little bit more hopeful because he's more moderate, but we just don't know what that means, correct?
Or what power he has, as John said, right?
Yeah.
Right. I think that's the hard part is, can he actually cut a deal? If he came into the president and said, look, I'm willing to allow international access to our facilities. We are willing to sign on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. We are willing to make clear in every possible written way that we can do that all we want is a nuclear energy program. We want international help. We accept international monitoring. You can have access anytime, anywhere, no restrictions. That's what the United States is looking for. Israel just doesn't believe Iran's ready to do that, and it believes it's a stalling tactic because it knows that, A, economic sanctions are punishing the economy, and, B, that the patience of the United States and Israel put up or shut up or deal with it with possible military action, that clock has been ticking. So Israel views it as a stall, and, to be honest, we don't know. Nobody knows. You have a newly elected president who has said and done some pretty remarkable things, acknowledging the Holocaust, trying to reach out to Jews, which Israel's last president thought should be annihilated and wiped off the planet. So he has said some amazing things. The question is, will he do tough things?
Marjorie asked you that question because she's embarrassed to ask you the question she really wants to talk to you about. Now, CNN had an exclusive. The microphones were on when the president thought they were off. The president was speaking to this guy who is a special rapporteur, he's called, to the UN. Listen carefully to this, and then I'll read to you exactly what he said, which is what Marjorie wants to ask you about. Here it is.
I'm scared of my life.
Okay, here's what happens. The president says, I hope you quit smoking. This guy says, sometimes. The president then says, no, 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 I haven't had a cigarette in probably 6 years. And then Barack Obama continues and says, that's because I'm scared of my wife. Marjorie's not buying it, John King.
I'm very suspicious, John King. But we'll ask you first. Do you buy this? I think we may have caught the president in a fib here. You guys have the exclusive at CNN.
Caught the president in a fib here, huh? Do we think he hasn't smoked in 6 years? I'm very skeptical to the 6 years part. I think the 6 years part is what would the Clintonian answer be? Depends on your definition of six. Or
yeah.
Depends on your definition of year.
Yeah.
Do I think that he is not smoking? That he has not smoked in a while, and that he doesn't smoke if he does cheat every now and then, it's very rare. Yes. And do I think that in part is because of the wrath of Michelle? I think absolutely. I don't think 6 years would hold up under oath. But I also think that, you know, again, as someone who watched my parents go through this and try to quit so many times many years ago, and saw the power of it over the two strongest people I've ever known in my life. Mm. The fact that he has pretty much quit with an occasional lapse, God bless him. And that's not a partisan statement. That's just somebody who watched smoking kill the two bravest, most wonderful people in my life. So I hope that he and anyone else out there is smart enough to walk away. And if you do it once a year, okay, but don't do it twice.
Okay, John King, let's move on to this terrible tragedy in Nairobi. We're learning that the Kenyans, at least, and we don't have this verified, but they're claiming that there were two or three Americans involved in this terrible attack, young men, 18, 19 years old. What do you make of it?
I talked to some intelligence folks yesterday, and they think it's possible, and one actually said it's probable, but they don't have independent confirmation yet. We do know somewhere between 36 and 40 Americans have been recruited to join Al-Shabaab. Most of them are Somali Americans, and the bulk of them actually come from the Minneapolis area. Some come from other places around the country, but there have been some non-Somalis who've decided to be radicalized and join the group. But we do know of somewhere in the ballpark of 36 to 40. We know of some of that have been killed in action, suicide bombers. And more recently, there was a guy from Alabama who apparently had some disagreements with the political leadership of the group and threatened to leave him. They killed him. No one will be surprised in the U.S. government in the end if, when they, if assuming these hostage takers are shot and killed and they count up the bodies, if there were two or three Americans in there. There's no question about that. And that has been part of the challenge. You know, when we have this debate about eavesdropping and NSA and wiretaps and emails and everything else, we tend to forget this sometimes because we focus on the big Al-Qaeda, the capital A, the capital Q. Yeah. This is a more traditional terrorism. Those people in the mall were terrorized. And because of the involvement in some Americans, these are the kind of people that are being followed quite aggressively. And their families, when they go overseas and they join these groups, but they occasionally contact home, those are the conversations that are being followed. And I think most Americans actually support that. It's the question of when you go broader. But it is a problem. No, there's no one in our government who thinks Al-Shabaab is capable of doing this, here. However, when something like this happens, you certainly go back and double and triple check that assumption.
Hey, John, let's come back to the United States for a minute. I am pro-civility in government. I don't like when Republicans scream at Democrats or Democrats scream at Republicans, but I love when there's intra-party screaming. When Peter King, a Republican congressman from New York, called Ted Cruz, a Republican senator from Texas, what a total fraud over the shutdown thing. I have to say, I loved it. But is Cruz a one-man band? Is there any chance there's going to be a shutdown 6 days from now? Or is this just Tea Party rhetoric coming out of the Texas senator?
Is there a chance? Yes. Is it likely? I think no, in the sense that the Texas Senator Ted Cruz has become the face of this, has become more isolated, and is growing a lot of enemies in his party in Washington. And I stress the in Washington part because that doesn't mean he's not doing himself a favor and building support out of the country. You find a lot of grassroots Republicans who, don't trust the Mitch McConnells and the John Boehners of the world anymore. Remember, the Tea Party started under George W. Bush and the bank bailouts. It's become more about Obama and Obamacare, but it started with conservatives who were mad at the Republican establishment. So when Ted Cruz pokes them in the eye, there are people out there who say, amen, keep going. The question is, how many of them are there? And it might take the Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina primaries in 2016 to answer that question. Things can change since then. But when you have people in his own party telling him to shut up or calling him a jerk or a clown, a guy like Bob Corker, who's a pretty moderate to conservative but a thoughtful Republican, saying things like, "Well, I didn't go to Princeton and Harvard, but I know how to count." I mean, some of them they're just PO'd by this because they think he walks into the room. Freshman senators don't usually have a lot of power, and this guy has created a national movement, and essentially he's created a mechanism where there are these groups out there now. When any Republican votes the other way, they know they're going to get slammed, and some of them are going to face primary challenges, and they think that that moves from what I'll call the politics of principle into the politics of stunt dummy.
But even though we're in 2013, don't Pyrrhic efforts like this on Cruz's behalf, and I assume it's not going to be the last one, doesn't this give him a huge leg up in places like Iowa caucuses years from now?
Yeah, well, that's the question, is the staying power of this, in the sense that, the party's in the middle of a civil war and in the middle of both an ideological and a generational transformation. And we won't know, we'll get markers on that. The 2014 midterm elections, do these Tea Party challenges against the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, has a Tea Party challenge back home. And that challenger is emboldened now because McConnell says he won't support the Cruz filibuster. Mike Enzi has Liz Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, running against him out in Wyoming. Lamar Alexander has a Tea Party challenge in Tennessee. Lindsey Graham does in South Carolina. So we'll get some evidence in the next several months of the potency of the Tea Party movement and this all or nothing movement. And that's the big question for the party. Do you run for office to be a governing conservative, which means, if you only control the House, you use your leverage in the Senate to cut the best deal possible. That's the philosophy of Boehner and Mitch McConnell. Or do you run as a all-or-nothing conservative, which if you're Ted Cruz and you don't have the votes to defeat Obamacare and take it off the books, then you're going to put a train in front of it every time you can, blocking funding and the like. It's a different philosophy. Now, most people who run for the legislature understand what they're doing. You're joining a government, and the basic job of governments, get your dictionary out, folks, is to govern. But he has a different philosophy, and he's probably safe in Texas saying that. But a majority of Americans, if you look at all the polls, even as opposition or skepticism or questions about the health care plan grow, and they are growing, no question about it, people don't think you go to the extreme of shutting down the government to make your point. And so Cruz is a little out over his skis here with the American people, but he's probably in a comfortable place with a decent slice of the Republican base. We just don't know how big that slice will be when we get around to Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, 2016.
Yeah, speaking of Obamacare, next time we talk to you on Tuesday will be the sign update, so that'll be at the top of our list. John King, thanks so much for your time. We'll talk to you soon.
Go Red Sox.
All right, we got to get to that next week, too.
John King joins us every Tuesday. Thank you again, John. He's CNN's chief national correspondent. Okay, when we come back, we're going to start talking to some mayoral candidates. We're also going to talk to Callie Crossley and David Bernstein about the mayor's race. Polls have opened just over 5 hours now. Who's going to win? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
League of Denial is Frontline's investigation into the NFL's concussion crisis.
I'm really wondering where this stops. I'm really wondering if every single football player doesn't have this.
You can check out a preview of the film along with a panel discussion with the filmmakers and New York Giants linebacker Harry Carson tomorrow at WGBH's Brighton Studios. For tickets and information, visit wgbh.org/events.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater, presenting the modern family musical La Cage aux Folles, starring the Nanny's Charles Shaughnessy. North Shore Music Theater in Beverly, September 24th through October 6th. NSMT.org. And Latino Americans, actor Benjamin Bratt narrates the rich and varied history of America's largest minority group and examines how they shaped the nation. Latino Americans continues Tuesday at 8 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This is something you will not be hearing after today.
As City Councilor Dan Conley took an early stand to establish full-day kindergarten.
We are Boston!
Marty Walsh, for Boston's future, for mayor.
When I decided to run for mayor, Mayor Menino told me to take it to the street. So, I'm Mike Ross, and this
Hola.
Is my plan.
Soy Felix Arroyo, y me estoy postulando para alcalde porque comparto sus valores.
John Conley showed great care and respect for our children by doing that.
I'm Rob Consalvo. I'm all in for Boston.
Come on, Boston. Let's think big.
I'm Bill Walsack, and I approve this message.
We're going to hear from a bunch of the mayoral candidates for a minute or two each as the day goes along. But here with us in Studio 3 now to go over the mayor's race are Callie Crossley, host of Under the Radar, and WGBH political analyst David Bernstein. He's also contributing editor to Boston Magazine. Happy Election Day to both of you.
Hello.
And by the way, if we throughout the up until 2 o'clock, we want your calls. If you voted, tell us what it was like at your polling place. If you decided not to vote and you're a Boston resident, admit it, and then we will eviscerate you right here on the radio show. Welcome, you two.
Good to be here.
Any early word on the turnout? Any reports on the polls?
Yeah, I've got 9 o'clock numbers. I don't have the 12 o'clock numbers yet, which is the next update from the city. The 9 o'clock numbers showed 17,000 and some had voted, which is a little under 5% or right around 5%. There seemed to be some discrepancies that were going back and forth. They had some problems with the numbers, but right around that area, which by my very rough, you know, comparison to other times would mean that we're looking at the low end of what the campaigns were sort of modeling on. So maybe 100,000 to 110,000 roughly. I mean, it depends on, you know what happens later in the day, obviously.
Yeah, it's a beautiful
day. Kelly, the 368,000 registered voters in Boston, 100,000 or something would be 30 to 33%, which with the first election, my blood pressure is rising as I speak, first election without an incumbent in two decades, it's pathetic, is it not?
That will be pathetic.
So how do you explain it when you have, I would say, at least 8, 9 really decent candidates?
A couple things. First of all, they said that the numbers, the people were coming in steadily but slowly. So I still have hope because I'm a Pollyanna about these things, particularly about voting. What I think is interesting is that, you know, the Globe had a big piece about how people are having a hard time deciding, that the numbers were overwhelming for them, that, you know, even the most thoughtful people who usually sit down with a group of friends, and I've done this too in my own town, and said, okay, what about this one? What about this one? What about this one? Are feeling as though they can only get to 3. And then they're still like, I'm not quite sure.
So I have an idea. I can't decide between the 3, so I won't vote today. In any case, hold your thought for a minute. We told you mayoral candidates are going to call in for literally a minute or two each today to just give us a final whatever with 7.5 hours till the polls close. The first amongst them, City Councilor Rob Consalvo. Rob, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Hi, guys. I'm glad to be here.
Hey, Mr. Three-Point Man. That was very impressive in those ads. So Rob Consalvo, if you're greeting a voter going into the polls today, what do you tell them? What's your final pitch in these last hours to get them to pull the lever for you?
Yeah, my pitch is that I'm the strongest candidate that has – the only candidate in the race with the – for what I call the trifecta of federal, state, and city experience, having worked in the United States Senate and in the legislature and on the city council – I can hit the ground running on day one on all levels of government, and particularly city government, to keep moving our city forward. The learning curve for me, I'm an advocate in city government, state government, and federal government. My record on the city council speaks for itself. The old saying, let the work I've done speak for me. There's nobody that's done more innovative ideas, more public policy initiatives, or ordinances that I've been able to bring forward that are now being used in our city to have us do this job smarter, better, faster, more efficient. And if you like what I did as a counselor, you're going to love the innovation I'll do as mayor. And I get a record and a real vision for moving our city forward on public safety and schools and city services, on the budget, and on creating an office of innovation and ideas to tap into the best ideas not only in Boston but around the world.
Hey, Rob, that voter disappeared 20 seconds ago. He had to go vote. Rob, before we let you go, win or lose today, we wish you luck. What's the one moment you take away from these past months that you're going to say it's what it's all about, it was great? What's the one moment?
I'll say the one moment is the fact that how incredible the voters and the public have been throughout this campaign in terms of, even if you knock a door and someone's not with you, there's been no animosity. If you knock a Marty Walsh voter's door, it's not that they don't slam the door in your face. They invite you in for a cold drink. They're really interested in what you have to say. It's been such a civil debate among our colleagues, among the public, people who aren't with you. Everyone in this whole process, I think, has been incredible in terms of the civility. And I actually think that this race, both the public and the candidates, and I'm so impressed with all my colleagues who ran, about how even though we had sharp disagreements on the issue, it's been civil and respectful. This should be the model of how all races should run, Rob, whether I win or lose.
Well said. Rob Consalvo, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Good luck today. Speaking of colleagues, he's got a colleague on the city council who's been atop the most recent polls, John Connolly. Welcome to Boston Public Radio. How are you, John?
Thanks, Jim. Good to be on.
So John Connolly, I'm wondering, you know, you have been atop all the polls, you know, by a little bit, some more significantly. But are you worried that people may say, OK, John Conley's a shoo-in and then vote for their number two choice and then you're left out in the cold?
I'll be honest with you. I worry about that and everything on election day. So I try not to pay attention to it. I got to tell you guys, you got a big listener and fan in my wife until you were talking about our garages yesterday.
I'm sorry.
That was Hillary Sargent's fault, ours.
No, we insulted the house. We called it a garage house. That was very unkind. Tell your wife we're very sorry.
Hey, John.
I think she's still a fan.
That's good. Hey, John, we just asked Rob Consalvo what his moment, his takeaway from these months. What's your take? What's the one moment that really did it for you here, John?
I'll give you two. One's just general in this sense that I think this whole field, I'm really proud to be part of this field because I think we showed Boston and the state that you can run a substantive positive campaign and everybody can do that. And I think everybody's done that. And it's so different from all the other campaigns today. I guess the second one, I'd just say, you know, it's coming out of a house party in Jamaica Plain. And a young woman couldn't, you know, maybe 15 years old, ran up to me and just grabbed me and just said, you know, thank you for caring about my school and not making that up. And it was this, you know, I would say you just don't expect 15-year-olds to run up to you and say stuff like that. And she was at Boston Arts Academy. And it meant a lot to me.
Well, hey, John Conley, we just got an emailer who voted for you because of the schools and for announcing you were going to run before Tom Menino ran out. Good luck today to you.
And tell your wife to clean up the garage in case things work out tonight, John, will you?
You just got me in huge trouble.
John Conley, good luck. Thanks
very
so much.
Thank you for calling.
We're in studio. We'll hear from other candidates today. We've invited them to call in just for a couple of minutes on the last day. We're with David Bernstein and Callie Crossley. Starting with you, David, yesterday when at 10 a.m. when the police commissioner said, "I'm leaving," standing by his side, practically glued to him, was the other Conley, Dan Conley, the Suffolk County DA. Does that help him today, his allegiance to and connection to a fairly popular outgoing police commissioner?
You know, Dan's taken some some criticism for you know, being up at the podium on all those Boston Marathon press conferences earlier, and for, you know, when he did the Boston Strangler announcements, and now this again, you know, people saying he's trying to take advantage and so on. You know, to some extent, yeah, of course he is. You know, he is trying to remind people, hey, I'm the DA, I'm an important person, I'm part of this, you know, team that you like, you know, that most people seem to be happy with. You know, but on the other hand, that's who he is. He is the DA. You know, I think, frankly, he hasn't done a good enough job of reminding people of that and sort of being I'm the grown up, I'm the guy.
But the physical image matters. Is that what, Kelly, when you see, even if he says the words, everybody watched a news clip yesterday of Davis said, "I'm out of here," essentially in a month or two. And when you see the physical proximity of the man, that has some sort of staying power, does it not?
If you know who he is.
You mean if you know who Dan Conley is?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I think he's standing there so he can say, "Hey, I'm Dan Conley, not John Connolly." I think that's why he's standing up there. But I'm serious. If you know who he is, maybe that has some impression on you. But again, I go back to my original statement, which is that people are struggling still. 30% of people are undecided. They don't know.
But you know, I think it will help Dan Conley, and because Ed Davis is very popular. He's not been that popular in the black community. A lot of people complaining that he shouldn't be the police commissioner. But Conley is the only front runner that has been steadfastly with Ed Davis. And, you know, it's going to be a small margin, I think. So why not take advantage of the popularity of Ed Davis from the marathon and other things and stand right next to him? And maybe he'll get, who knows, 50 well, extra votes, 200 extra votes, 500 extra votes.
Let me flip that and say, if you get in the booth and you're thinking to yourself, how do I make a decision if I've got down to my three or my
right.
two at this point? Then I think these are the questions. Who do I want to pick the next police commissioner? Who do
and
I want?
And school superintendent.
I was about to say that. Who do I want to pick the next school superintendent? And whose ideas are resonating with mine along those lines?
Yep.
And if I've got issues, even though I think Ed Davis is a great guy, but there's some issues that I think he didn't clean up, that's a problem for me. If I thought Carol Johnson was a breath of fresh air and Menino did a good thing, but toward the end, maybe not so much, caved into the charter schools, maybe, as you think that, that's a big deal for people.
We're now joined in line by another guy who would like to appoint the head of the police department and the head of the Boston schools. That would be City Councilor Felix Royal. Hey, Felix.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
I apologize for the background noise. I'm in East Boston and Liberty Square here doing a walkabout and wanted to call in.
That's okay. Felix Arroyo, I've never seen a guy with more enthusiasm during those debates than you have shown. Give us your pitch for the last couple of seconds. If you're just going to meet a voter, tell them why they should cast a vote for you today.
Well, I was listening to Callie Crosby say that 30% of the electorate undecided. I think all 30% are listening to Jim and Marjorie right now, trying to close the deal. So allow me the opportunity to talk to all of those thousands of voters
okay.
and say that. You know, if you agree with me that Boston can and should be the city where everyone has access to opportunities, regardless of who you are or what neighborhood you come from, if you know, you believe we should create pathways out of poverty and into the middle class for the 1 in 5 Bostonians living in poverty, and if you believe that our Boston public schools have got to work for everyone in this city, and we have got to close the achievement gap, and that everyone deserves a voice in the direction of this city, then I'm going to ask you to please consider voting for me, Felix Arroyo, to be the next mayor of the city of Boston. And frankly, I'm honored for all who have considered me, and I'm so grateful for the many who have decided to vote for me. And we're really looking forward to the results tonight.
Hey, Felix Arroyo, we wish you a lot of luck. Thanks for calling
Thank
in.
Thank you.
And
Thank
we're hoping
you.
All 30% of those undecideds were listening. Felix, be well. Good
Thanks,
luck today.
Felix, good
Absolutely.
Luck.
Thank you for the time. And if all 30% can, I'll turn off the radio.
Felix, thanks so much for the call. Callie Crossley, I am math was the only subject I was really good in school. So what I did
horrible.
The other day is I took the Suffolk University poll. I totaled up all the votes for white candidates, 59%. Mm-hmm. I totaled up all the votes for candidates of color, 21%, 3-1. We're a majority-minority city. If a person of color doesn't make it to the final two, we wake up tomorrow morning, what's the statement? What's being said?
I think it says that we're not a city ready to go forward in some ways. And I think, you know, the question that was raised by somebody smarter than me is the next person an urban mechanic, as often Thomas Menino has been described, or is the next person a visionary, really pushing some boundaries into the next, century? And, you know, I think that if there isn't someone who's very if they don't make it, but really close, then I wonder about that visionary part, because we're talking about not just a city that is currently majority-minority, but a nation that is majority-minority in just a few years. In fact, as we speak, all of the kids under 5 at this moment, right now, September 24th, 2013, mostly majority-minority.
Yeah.
What do you think it says, David Bernstein, if that's the outcome at 10 o'clock tonight?
Well, I wouldn't read quite as much into it. I do think it's a surprise that we might end up with, you know, two white Irish guys in the final. I don't think most people would have, you know, including myself, would have guessed that. But I would say a couple things. First of all, I would point out so far in those 9 o'clock numbers I mentioned, the majority black precincts are turning out at a lower level relative to where they normally do, and particularly compared to where they normally do as a percentage of the whole city in some of the elections where we've had like a Deval Patrick or someone like that for them to get excited about. And so part of it is that they haven't gotten excited about any particular candidate. Maybe portions of them are excited about Charlotte Golar Richie, or portions are excited about John Barros, but you haven't seen anyone
yet, or Felix.
But you haven't seen anyone yet really, you know, generate that kind of enthusiasm. And what I was going to say is that one of the things that just seems to have happened in this go-round, just the timing, is that a number of the candidates who you would expect to have the best chance to get that excitement just didn't run for one reason or another. You know, Andrea Cabral, the sheriff, just happened to have taken this new position in Deval Patrick's
Secretary
cabinet.
Public Safety, yeah.
State Senator Sonia Chang Diaz just happened to be pregnant and decided she couldn't, you know, run for office. Linda Dorsina-Forey happened to have been in the middle of a state Senate race. Ayanna Presley, for various reasons, you know, decided it wasn't, mm-hmm. you know.
City councilor, yeah.
So, you know, it could just be more of a coincidence of, you know, of who happened to run than anything. But I think it does still say something about, you know, do we see that white Boston is unwilling to take that close look at a John Barros and Felix Arroyo and Charlotte Golar Richie?
If you guys want to join us, our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We're talking mayoral politics for a lot today. We're going to be talking about it until 1 o'clock with Callie and David Bernstein. You know, on the thing about the black vote, you hear a lot of people in high crime areas in Boston which kind of surprised me, that I've talked to, said they're voting for Dan Conley because he's the DA and because they are sick of the gunfire, and they think a Law and Order guy is gonna change things. So you never know.
Well, I find that you get very strong feelings for and against Dan Conley.
Yeah.
As Dan Conley points out himself, he's the guy who has been there for the victims who are disproportionately, so he's helped put away people who have attacked, people's family members. So there is that part of it.
You know, in a second, I'm sorry, Kelly.
Can I just
sure,
make
of course.
A point? I think it's important to note that across the board, I mean, it's really difficult to think of black vote or any sort of minority community voting as a block this time around, because in the way that you've just described people supporting Dan Conley, people are spread across the board.
Yeah.
And I think that needs, and the other way too. I mean, I think people need to pay attention to that. I do note, however, that we're listening to Felix Arroyo just a few minutes ago, and East Boston is 53% Latino. So now, if he can bring that constituency home, to the polls, there's only a few. I'm looking at where are those block constituencies that can really push you over it when percentage points are so very close.
That's Kelly Crossley. He is David Bernstein. We'll get back to them in a minute. We're going to get your calls in a second. But speaking of East Boston, where there might end up being a casino, joining us on the phone is Bill Walczak, a candidate for Mayor of Boston. Bill, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, and I am in East Boston right now.
Yeah.
That's a motorcycle going by.
But I thought it was a slot machine.
At East Boston High School, and where there are several precincts voting, and it looks looks lively here.
I know that you were a little bit concerned, Bill, about some confusion about you and the district attorney, Dan Conley, about the casino situation. You are strongly, you want to straighten that out and tell us why you're so strongly opposed to a casino in Boston?
Right. I'm the candidate who's opposed to the casino in Boston. Dan Conley is the candidate who says that he's agnostic about whether there should be a casino in Boston. And if you want to stop the casino, I'm the only candidate that's out there saying I will stop the casino. So that's what the voters need to understand. If they really care about this casino as the major issue facing Boston, then I'm the candidate who's the only one to say it'll stop it.
Hey, Bill Walczak, I don't know if you're the only one, but you're not the only one. But there, most of the people who are running in this race have either run for elective office, held elective office. As a guy who's made your reputation in the private sector, what's it like putting yourself out naked, sort of, in front of voters? I'm
He's
serious.
Not naked, Jim.
Well, you know what I mean. I mean, essentially, they're judging you to a degree. What's it like running for office after what you've done with most of your life? What's that been like for you?
It's really different. And if you ever decide you want to get into this game, talk to me first. It is a totally different, because I'd always been involved in leadership issues around, my neighborhood or around
sure.
the city of Boston, whether it's creating Boston Medical Center or the Common Square Health Center. I thought I knew what it was like to be in the public eye, but there's nothing like being a candidate. You're in the public eye continuously. There's different kinds of expectations. There's people who don't like you because of stuff that you say, and they have no problem saying it. And I think there's also this sense that politicians are just kind of, there's open season on politicians. Okay, you can say anything to them because they're politicians. That's very different from being a leadership person. In
hey, win or lose, I feel a book coming out of Bill Walczak. Is that a safe assumption, Bill?
Yeah, I've actually talked to some of the other candidates about it, too, especially Harris is a close friend, and we've talked about this kind of really being interesting coming out of the nonprofit sector as leadership people and going into the political sector. It's a very different experience.
That is. Good luck today, Bill. Thanks.
Thank you very much for calling in, and good luck in the race today.
Hey, can I just say that? First of all, we have some good sense of humor among the mayoral candidates, which I think is terrific. But I just wanted to pass something along, because I got some intel this morning from one of my political insiders that there was supposedly this big political powwow happening at Santarpio's at 12:30.
Boston?
In East Boston.
That's where they just called from, two in
so
a row.
We just got two in a row from East Boston. No joke. I got this intel that there was this whole, the Senate president was going to be there.
Really?
And State
Which
Senator
Senate Pinsel. President? There are two right
Terry
now,
Murray?
Right? I'm kidding.
I think both, actually.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure exactly
about what?
I don't know.
Maybe
some of our East Boston listeners, it could just be lunch.
They do have great pizza.
Maybe someone in East Boston can pop by and see what's going on there, because that's those you know, are a little coincidental that two of them just called in from East Boston after what I heard. That's all I'm saying.
That is interesting. And one was in a walking tour, so he may have been walking to Centaur.
And the other one sounded like he had pizza in his mouth. We're talking to Callie Crossley and David Bernstein. And David, I want you to prepare, because after we take a call or two, I'm going to ask you to name, without any notes, all 19 at-large city council candidates. Are you up for that?
I knew
you could.
I could do the whole city council.
Please don't. All 48. Brian, you're from West Roxbury on Boston Public Radio with all four of us. Thanks for the call, Brian.
Hi, everyone.
Hi.
I was just calling in. I was down at Holy Name, West Roxbury, and not very many voters there, but walking in, you got to go through about a gauntlet of politicians and campaign workers, including about 10 feet from the entrance, you have John Connolly's mother asking you to vote for her son, and then Dan Connolly shaking your hand and opening the door for you. It's quite a scene.
I'm going to admit something that I've never admitted publicly. I voted for someone years ago, and I take the voting really seriously, like I hope everybody does. I voted for somebody in a race where I wasn't clear about the candidates. And in those cases, I usually blank it, because this guy's daughter greeted me at the corner of Inman Street and Broadway and was the most persuasive young woman, and I just couldn't say no. So did you vote? Well, I will ask you. Did you vote for the mother's kid?
I will tell you this, that if I wasn't so sure of who I was voting for, she would have gotten me, because the way she looked at me, I was like, oh, of course, I got to vote for her. I got to vote for her son. But now I voted for Robbie. He's
Consalvo.
He's the guy that I, yep.
Great. Brian, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
By the way, Holy Name, that Rotary in West Roxbury, that's a huge a voting place. I mean, that's West Roxbury. They're big-time voters in West Roxbury.
That's
where turnout has been relatively heavier in West Roxbury and Dorchester, which I tend to believe is because of the get-out-the-vote efforts of John Connolly and Marty Walsh.
Yeah.
Those are the areas. I actually just got in the 12 o'clock numbers.
What's the deal?
Hold on, I'm opening it up. So, you know, talk amongst yourselves.
We'll talk amongst ourselves. I came for the title for Bill Walzek's book.
What is it?
Stop Yelling at Me.
No, but I thought that was a really honest call that he gave out. Yeah.
Let me ask you something, girl to girl. We have one woman running in this race, and it's Charlotte Goerla-Ritchie. And a lot of people had high hopes for her. You know, every time I go someplace, I see all these other women talking about Charlotte Goerla-Ritchie, But maybe she'll do it. Maybe she'll do it. She was in fourth in the Herald poll, and she was inching up somewhat. But I was kind of surprised that she hadn't caught fire. What's your analysis, Ms. Crossley, over there?
Well, I mean, there's a couple things going on there. First of all, let's start with the positive, and that is she had a big fundraiser about a week ago, and it was jam-packed.
Yeah.
And she got the endorsement of Sonia Chang Diaz, a name that David mentioned, who might have been a person to run for office herself. That is a heavy weight, because Sonia Chang Diaz's endorsement was sought by other people. I think some people in deciding to vote for whom they will vote today will take that into consideration. That's when an endorsement does make some sense, for folks.
And I wonder whether a number of women who maybe, like you said, are down to three candidates, one of them being Charlotte Goerla-Ritchie, might say, you know what, I'll push her through to the final, and then I'll figure out whether I'm going to vote for her in the final. But, you know, maybe I'd like to see a woman in the final. That may help her in the end.
Yeah.
So what's the turnout deal for us?
I've got, as of noon, 39,451 ballots cast, which is 10.7%. That's up a little bit from, so that's a little bit brisker pace.
Our number is 877-301-8970. I assume everybody knows, but the polls are open till 8 o'clock today, so you have 7 hours and 12 minutes to cast your vote. And there's not much reason
for people not to.
Yes.
You may have an answer, or maybe David does, and wisdom is all political wisdom.
I can make this one up.
Okay. Traditionally, when do people vote? What time in general? Is it... Because in my family, always when I grew up, and I reversed it as an adult, we always voted after my parents worked.
That's the traditional wisdom, actually, is that the minority precincts and sort of the working class precincts generally tend to vote after work. Mm-hmm. Precisely because of what you say. They sort of get in that pattern because they tend to go to work earlier. They tend to have less leeway in when they can get to work. They tend to have bus rides to get to work, as you know, from the minority communities, not so much easy getting into work from there. So you often see a little bit heavier from them later in the day. Also, it depends on sort of who's doing the voter turnout, you know, which is interesting. If, you know, Charlotte Goler-Ritchie, if she has a good voter turnout organization, she can sort of what they call a blind pull through the minority communities, which is not worrying just about the ones who have told you they are definitely voting for you. You can sort of pull everybody and figure, you know, maybe you'll get 50% and the others will go elsewhere, but it'll still help you. So she could really benefit from that. That's something that Tom Menino used to do. He used to do blind polls. He would do very specified polls elsewhere, you know, just going to those what they call the number one houses. But he would do blind polls through parts of the black community and near his home in Hyde Park, where he knew he was getting the vast bulk. We'll see if that happens here. Remember, we're going to have, like you said, there's 19 people running for at large. There's all these, you know, district councilors.
29 more.
You know, they're all doing their own polling, too. They've got people who they're going to have. And that happens more after work than before work. So, you know.
You know what I'm glad neither of you have done, by the way? The thing that's driven me most nuts about the coverage is some reporters, and surely not all, when a candidate says, I have 34,000 volunteers working for me today. These numbers are so preposterous. Everybody has the best turnout operation.
Excuse me, Mr. Reporter over there.
Yes.
How would you verify that, Mr. Journalist, when you went out and were
told
by Dan Conley?
I think what you would say is John Doe suggests,
that's
says.
Right. That's what you do.
Well, they don't always say that.
Oh, yes, they do.
No, that is
they
not. I'll give you a perfect example. Says. It may be true. Marty Walsh, because he's got a labor background. Yeah. Marty Walsh, every reporter said he's got the best GOTV, get out the vote, because he's got labor, all this sort of thing. How do you know? Maybe he does. How does anybody know that he's got the best?
Marty Walsh says he's got.
You know what I did when I spoke to Marty last time? I said, give me all 2,000 names, and I'm going to call them.
I don't like it when these anchormen start criticizing the reporters. You know what I'm saying? Out there in the street.
Yes, you may.
I want to raise something that I've raised before, which could be totally, you know, be blown out of the water by David Bernstein, my favorite political analyst.
Yes.
But this is my
theory. He's my second favorite, but go ahead.
I'm going to predict some reverse coattails, a little bit of what David was saying about the blind pull. And I've been particularly focused on the Chinese and the Asian community because there are two strong candidates for city council. Suzanne Lee running in the district race. She only lost by 97
against
Bill Linehan. She has been out there stumping, trying to get people out. And then you got Michelle Wu, very popular, and people just assume she's going to make it to the end. So cannot in those folks who are determined to get those two in, I'm in the booth. Let's see who else I'll vote for. So that might drive
quick
up
answer, because we have one of our colleagues actually at Santarpio's. You said Santarpio's.
Uh-huh.
But what's a quick answer?
My quick answer is yes, it can happen. As a matter of fact, I was talking to a City Hall insider just this morning, and we both said to each other, if Michelle Wu was black, Charlotte Goler-Ritchie would get into the final.
So you agree with Kelly.
So I agree, because of the enthusiasm that she's pulling.
Let me tell you what kind of operation we have here. David Bernstein, off the cuff, mentioned Santarpio's. 6 seconds later, our colleague Adam Riley is at Santarpio's in East Boston. Okay, Adam, does David Bernstein know what he's talking about or what? Is there a big
intel? How's my intel? I'm being verified. I'm being fact-checked. Uh-oh.
What's going on over there, Adam?
Well, there's a big luncheon that they do. They usually do it in state election years, and it's for the various candidates who are fighting each other at the ballot box to get together and, you know, either show that they like each other or pretend that they like each other. And that's pretty much what's going on right now. It's hosted by Sal LaMattina, the city councilor who represents East Boston. And the political turnout here, Tom Menino actually just rolled up. And it was like watching a head of state arrive. It took him a while to get out of his car. You can tell he really is moving with difficulty. I asked him what it's like to watch, you know, after 20 years running the city, what's it like to watch your successors heading into the home stretch? And he said, and the look on his face made me think that he meant it. You know, he said it's bittersweet and it's kind of difficult to watch, but that it is, in fact, time for Boston to move on and get a new mayor. He wouldn't hazard any predictions about what the outcome is going to be. But just to give you guys a sense of how packed this thing is, if you walk in, if you've been to Santarpio's before, you walk in the door and the bar is sort of right there. And then to the left of the bar, there's just a dining area. And to the left of that, there's sort of a function room. And that's where all these people are in the function room. And I'm just going to start throwing out some names of people who have shown up. Terry Murray, the Senate president, is there. Bob Travellini, her predecessor Senate president, now obviously a highly paid lobbyist, is there. Chip Tuttle of Suffolk Downs is there. Senator Petruccelli, State Rep Basil, Sal Lamatina, the city councilor. Charlotte Gohler Ritchie was the first mayoral candidate who showed up. Rob Consalvo is there now. I think Theo Chiloio is on the way. And I'm probably blanking on some other names, but it's and then obviously the biggest of all is Tom Menino, who made that dramatic entrance.
So did you ask Menino who he voted for, Adam?
You know, I didn't ask him who he voted for.
Yeah, he wasn't going to tell you anyway.
Did you ask him how he liked the front page of Boston Magazine, the cover of Boston Magazine, which called him petty, thin-skinned, and ruthless?
Whoa.
That was a pretty tough headline.
No, but it ends saying he may be the best mayor in Boston history.
It does. But the big words are petty, thin-skinned, and ruthless.
I actually wanted to get the mayor to talk to me, so I didn't want to crush me aside.
I thought that was pretty tough on the cover of Boston Magazine. You worked there, Boston Magazine. Do you have any intel on that?
I have a couple of little items in that piece. I'm going to be working on getting a signed copy from him. I'm not sure if we'll see how that goes.
Hey, Adam, have a slice of pizza on David. Thanks so much for calling in.
Will do.
Live from San Tarpio's in East Boston.
Here's an interesting email from, I think it's Nancy. She said, last year I stood in line for 2.5 hours in the middle of the day in my minority-majority neighborhood of JP to vote in the presidential race. I voted at 10 a.m. today, and there were only two people in front of me.
I don't even want to hear about turn. I can't even handle this. I really can't. I can't. In any case, David, let me ask you.
By the way, I have a post up at Boston Magazine with 10 things that are contributing to low turnout today, just if you want to take a look.
Well, give us a couple.
Yeah. One that's not obvious. Yeah. What's?
There are a number of them. One of them is that might not be obvious, and this is my own perception, is that the news media in this town was not particularly well prepared for a big local political election this year for a number of reasons.
Big meaning large numbers or big meaning important?
Important. Okay. And of course they were also hampered by there being many other big stories to cover at the time. But, you know, because of all the downsizing in the newsrooms, one of the things they've cut out is local political coverage. So at the start of the race, they didn't know these people. You know,
That's
they didn't
true.
Know any of these candidates.
That
so it was
true.
A big field of unknowns that they didn't know how, they didn't know what the backstories
yeah,
were.
Don't you think the Globe and the Herald have been all over 11 and a half of these people?
No, I don't.
And we miss a lot of the juice.
I would say that if you go back to the months, I would say in the last few weeks, yes. But, you know, I mean, I just did, and I'm not trying to criticize. I'm saying that there are legitimate reasons that they were. And remember, the Globe was going through a sale. Mm-hmm. The Globe had just lost its editor. Marty Baron had just lost Glenn Johnson, its top, local political guy. So they were in a big transition. And you know, like, just to throw out a couple of examples, I just did a couple of posts recently, and I'm not trying to, put myself better than them, but because they have done some great stuff. I did a thing comparing the council votes of the five city councilors who were running for mayor. Nobody had done that, in 5 months. You know, there's this big question on Marty Walsh, how does he handle negotiating something that involves labor? Well, he was involved in a big thing, he co-chaired the special commission on public labor reform that was a big deal for labor. So I wrote about what he did there and, how the perception was there. Again, that's something if you haven't been following local politics, if you haven't been following local politics, you don't know, Marty Walsh's involvement in the District 3 Frank Baker shootout.
Yeah, I have to say.
And so on. So I just think that's been part of the.
May I just second this for a second?
Part of it.
We used to have 2 and 3 people at City Hall, 2 and 3 people at the State House, 4 and 5 people at the State House.
That's
we
right.
can't do it anymore because newspapers, and everybody says, we don't care about newspapers because we can get the thing from the radio and television. It was the newspapers that were on the ground doing all this stuff when you were at the Boston Phoenix and we had bigger bureaus. So if you don't think it hurts, it hurts.
I'm not saying it does, but I have to say, as
the
a
Herald
non-Bostonian.
Has done some good stuff, but they have so few people.
We have
they
so
just
few people.
Can't.
I, feel,
it's a
I have to
era.
Say, again, we can't debate this today, but we can do it as a postmortem. I feel I've learned so much about 11 of these people, and maybe they're holes, and you probably are right, but I think the report has been terrific. Having said that, let me ask you this, Kelly, starting with you and then David. Every one of the last 4 polls has had the same 4 people in different – Connolly's been atop all of them, but two, three, and four have been the other Connolly, Dan Connolly, Charlotte Gohler Ritchie, and Marty Walsh, depending on the poll. Who is the most likely, in your estimation, of the non-4 that I just mentioned to maybe surprise us to sneak into the second spot or maybe even the first spot tonight? Is there somebody or is it down to those 4?
I think it's probably going to be down to those 4 for the numbers, but I think Felix Arroyo or John Barrows could come up. That's going to be my guess.
How about you, David Bernstein? Is there somebody? I hate top tier, second tier, but all four have been in the top four spots in all four recent polls. Is there a fifth?
Well, I do think that it's those four fighting for the two spots, but I also agree with Callie that the ones who are likely to do, in my opinion, better than they've been polling are John Barrows and Felix Arroyo and possibly Mike Ross, who also has been gaining a lot of traction recently. So you could see, you could see them getting up into that top tier. It's a little hard to see that they could pass all of the people in front of them to get into the top two, but you never know. I mean, especially in a low turnout, you get your people to the polls. You know, it may only take 18 to 20,000 votes to get in that top two. That's not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot. By the way, 18,000 to 20,000 votes is the number of votes in a hot state Senate election. We're talking about the city of Boston. Go vote. Richard, you're in Truro. Very quickly, you're on Boston Public Radio with Callie, David, Jim, and Marjorie. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Jim. How you doing?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure. What's up?
Listen, the reason I'm calling is because I think Marty Walsh is oftentimes unfairly criticized because of his profession. As a union representative, I think he compares well with another mayor. That is Mayor Vigorosa in
Los Angeles,
who has a similar background in him in this way. They're both first-generation Americans. They both were state legislators, and they both were union leaders. And he was a great mayor. He's considered the leading candidate for governor of California. I think Marty Walsh is also, even though I don't agree with all of the votes that he's taken as a state legislator, as a union person, I think he's taken some tough votes that prove that he puts the taxpayers first, and that he's going to be a great leader.
Richard, thank you for the call. I mean, I think he can make the case that while he's been hurt by it, and on some fronts, he's been helped by it, because this is a real test, in my opinion, of labor strength. If they can't produce in a race with a dozen candidates, they probably can't produce.
But I also think, in fairness to Marty Walsh, he has proved his independence from the Boston Teachers Union. I'm not a fan of the Boston Teachers Union because he has been willing to say we need to have more charter schools, we need more reform, and they don't like that. And, if he's certainly not in their pocket, that's for sure. And he was tough with the firefighters as well. And they're a tough union to negotiate with in Boston.
Can I just say this?
You may.
Jeff Daniels won the other night. I'm saying that because
you never know.
I think he split the vote. I'm serious.
Which is exactly what.
This is why. This is relevant. I just wasn't being.
We talked to Bob. We asked Bob Thompson, the Syracuse guy, who's the TV expert yesterday. How did Jeff Daniels sneak in? Even though I think he's good, and he said exactly what you said. Is everybody focused on Kevin Spacey? And obviously on Bryan Cranston and a few others, and then all of a sudden they canceled each other out, and so there it is.
You go.
So everybody's hoping they're Jeff Daniels today.
There's
is that correct,
David? If it happens,
well, that's why John Conley's worried about people saying, "Well, he's going to win anyway, so we'll vote for number two." That's scary.
There's no question. It was a perfect question to ask him because I've asked his people, his campaign people, and there's no question that they're worried about that.
Yeah.
That people are going to think he's too safe, so they'll vote for someone else. What I would say is the whole splitting the vote and sneaking in and having labor sort of helping you out. That's very, very helpful in the preliminary because you only have
absolutely
to get to
right.
maybe 25%. But then where do you go when you have to get into the final? Are there too many people citywide who just are not going to trust a labor guy to negotiate labor contracts for the city? I think that like the caller said, Marty has a very strong case to make, but he's going to have to make that case if he gets into the final because you can't just have the labor vote.
David Bernstein, Callie Crossley, as always, thanks so much for your take on this.
Callie Crossley is host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. You can hear that every night, every Sunday night at 6:30. And David Bernstein is WGBH's political analyst and a contributing editor to Boston Magazine, the one that called Mayor Menino petty, ruthless, and thin-skinned on its cover.
And then went on to say he may be the best mayor in Boston history.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about local elections with a focus on the governor's race. We're continuing our series of every Tuesday having someone that's running for the Democratic nomination for governor. We're joined next by Joe Avalone in 89.7 WGBH's Boston Public Radio studio. Stay tuned.
Thanks.
The
It's the home of Jim and Marjorie. When they moved to WGBH, I was thrilled.
It's always a thrill to get more of what you love. And when you support WGBH as a sustainer, that's exactly what you get. Sustainers enjoy the ease of monthly installments and the convenience of automatic renewal. And if 7,000 sustainers sign on before the end of the year, then every WGBH station and program will go fundraiser-free this February. Track the progress at WGBH.org/sustainer.
We love our contributors. That means you. And AAA Southern New England, helping and serving members for more than 110 years with roadside assistance, insurance and financial products, and a full-service travel agency. Details at AAA.com. AAA, membership for life. And Roger Williams University, presenting oceanographer Sylvia Earle on September 25th as part of the President's Distinguished Speaker Series. You can find more information at rwu.edu. That's rwu.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. In a couple of minutes, we'll get back to your calls about the mayor's race and others of the 12 candidates. Well, 11 candidates will be joining us in the last 40 minutes of this hour. But first, it's open mic. Charlie Baker, as you know, used to join us every Tuesday at 1. Now that he's jumped into the governor's race on the Republican side, we've turned his seat and his mic over to the Democratic gubernatorial candidates. So far, we've been joined by Juliette Kayyem, Don Berwick. Today, Joseph Avalone joins us. Joe is a surgeon. Currently, he's corporate senior vice president at ParXL International. Joe, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to be a replacement for Charlie.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. Well, I got to ask you, I mean, I've been a reporter forever, covering politics forever. You've had a spectacular career. You know, Harvard Medical School, and you're a surgeon, and you were a big deal at Blue Cross, COO of Blue Cross, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and then you're at this other firm now that does all this work in chemical trials and stuff like that. Why do you want to run for governor? It's grueling. It's thankless. Get battled around. Why do you want to do this?
Well, that's a great question. I want to do it because I think I can make a very big difference. I think my background actually in the private sector is what I'm bringing, and a lot of new ideas. And it's, I think the state, given what it needs to do for the rest of this decade, needs somebody with a background like mine. I think I can make the difference. I've always been interested in public policy, lifelong Democrat, been on lots of campaigns. Was even Paul Tsongas' healthcare advisor when I was younger during his presidential campaign. So I've always wanted to make a difference in the public sector, but, you know, I've been making a living and raising kids, and now I know with my background I can make a difference.
Okay, so your kids are all grown up. They won't be crying if dad goes off on the campaign trail. Okay.
They all grew up. They all got married within the last 13 months. Can
wow.
you believe that?
Wow. Well, I hope they weren't all girls.
The last one was a girl. That was a big deal. But
okay. Always take out a second mortgage.
So one of the big things that you've talked about is you know, everybody talks about the public schools are struggling, and Massachusetts does better than a lot of other states, but we're still struggling. You've talked about extraordinary measures to fix failing and at-risk schools. Yeah. So what would those extraordinary measures be? Are you for more freedom from the rules, or what's your deal?
Well, first of all, I think you're right on. I think one of the two biggest issues facing our state is closing that achievement gap. I mean, every year, yes, we have good statistics and therefore a very good school system when you look at it nationally, but we also have some of the largest achievement gaps in the country. And that means every year thousands of kids are essentially not going to be able to participate in the new economy or have a fulfilling life. And every year that goes by, it's another number of thousands. So this is something we've got to do as a high priority, and we can do. Extraordinary measures it's going to take. It's going to take help from the state. I'm going to be putting my K-12 policy on my website within a couple of weeks, but it'll have some extraordinary measures like funded pre-K for 3- and 4-year-olds in the low-performing districts. It'll have extended day in the low-performing schools. It'll also have innovation grants for people to try new things. That we would judge, and I'm going to fund a fair amount of it out of a kind of a social investment funding mechanisms where we'll establish a fund, but especially with the leverage that pre-K gets, you can get a big return within 4 or 5 years as soon as you can show that people are literate at grade 3. That's a huge deal, and I think we can sort of pay back the fund from the savings of lack of repeating years and lowered special needs costs.
Just one more thing about the schools before we go, because these are kind of the hot button issues with schools, things like merit pay for teachers as opposed to everybody getting paid the same amount. How about that? And how about like more charter schools, because they are showing some great successes?
So I think what we need is a lot of flexibility with the at-risk three schools and the four schools. And rather than prescribing in each school system what is the answer, what I want is a high priority for the state. I'm going to be my own education czar. I'm going to have my departmental heads meet with me monthly. We're going to have tracking metrics. We're going to set our objectives, which is close the achievement gap by the end of the decade and make everybody career college ready in the state. And I'm going to have monthly reviews. We're going to have tracking metrics, and we're going to meet this goal.
Have the teachers unions, the Mass Federation of Teachers and the Mass Teachers Association been good for public education in Massachusetts or not so good, Joe Avalon?
I think the teachers unions vary. The two of them are quite different. And rather than get into specifics, I think there are moments when the teachers can, I think, come along. And then there are moments when I think at least one of the teachers' unions has probably retarded progress.
Whoa. Which teachers' union has retarded progress and on what issue?
I don't think we need to go into it. I think
Why don't we need to go into it?
Well, because I'm going to take every case as it is, and it depends on the school system.
No, but you say there is a specific example that troubles you. Why you don't want to share with us?
I think some school systems have resisted merit pay or other kinds of evaluation, and I think we got to move in that direction.
You know, you said help from the state, and then you talked about a funding mechanism. A lot of what you said sounds like what Deval Patrick was saying when he was pitching his $2 billion.
No, I don't think so, because I'm not calling for a lot of new taxes.
Well, that's what I want to ask you. He said he wanted roughly $1 billion for education, particularly early childhood education, $1 billion for transportation. In your announcement video, you talk a lot about transportation infrastructure.
Yeah.
Should I assume, based on what you just said, that you did not support his $2 billion
initiative? No, I did not support
it. Why?
Because I've been all over this state. I've been in 105 towns, had over 250 events, and there are big pockets of very high unemployment still in the state. In fact, the state is so uneven right now that as the economy improves, it's not going to necessarily improve in lots of our areas. So I thought it was the wrong time to have any kind of a broad-based tax. And so I did agree ultimately with the idea of a more limited infrastructure tax, which is what the legislature did. I also was dead set against the software tax. And as soon as it came out, I had a press release against it, and I have worked actively against it. I know I was the only Democratic candidate that came out against it in the beginning.
We should also say, for those who don't know, we're going to discuss that with the governor tomorrow. The three Democratic leaders on Beacon Hill have agreed to repeal that, which they just did a couple of months ago. We're speaking to Joe Avalon. He's a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor in 2014.
You know, you were a surgeon and you worked with Blue Cross. You have a unique perspective on healthcare in Massachusetts. You said we need to change healthcare delivery right here in Massachusetts, where we've had universal health care for quite some time. What's wrong with the system?
You know, I think one of the things that works in Massachusetts is universal health care. I'm proud that we have it. It's great that we had it. We were forerunners. And it's really interesting to listen to the national debate with all the angst when I think we can show, hey, it works right here in Massachusetts. One of the things that works is universal health care. Step two is controlling health care costs. That was always going to be step two. We're at step two. What we do have to do now is get to a more stable base of affordable health care, and we can do it. We have to change the way our medical delivery system is organized and move towards larger organized systems of care. There are known models around the country on how to do that. We just have to have the political will to do it, and we will do it.
You know, we talked to Bill Walczak a couple of minutes ago, and unlike Bill, while you come from the private sector, you actually served as a selectman, did you not, in Wellesley X number of years?
Yeah.
But selectman's one thing. I was a city councilor for one term, so I know it's different.
Stellar.
Well, I retired undefeated, Marjorie. Let's put it that way. And all of a sudden, you're running for the big job in Massachusetts. Just like, what's it like, all of a sudden, putting yourself out there as opposed to doing what you did in the private sector? What's it like for you?
First of all, I know Bill Walczak and know him well, and I know his experiences, and I heard his his answer. It's been absolutely exhilarating. I've been, as I said, 105 towns, been at it for 8 months. I've met literally thousands of people, and I can tell you it is wide open. It is a wide open race, so I don't feel like I'm running to catch up with anybody.
People don't treat you like a – I mean, I don't mean this at all in a disrespectful way, but Martha Coakley, big name. Steve Grossman, big name. Juliette Kayyem, well, not in that class in terms of profile, CNN, Globe, et cetera. Don't you get personally set back or offended when people say, how can you possibly run against these huge political figures in Massachusetts?
You know what I find? I literally find it's either kind of reruns versus new ideas. And I think people are looking for new ideas. They're looking for new, and they're very willing to talk about new people. I don't think people are all that interested in reruns. And I think that's what we're going to get with probably Steve, Martha, and Charlie. Whereas I think I'm new, and people are very interested in that.
Speaking of Charlie, you have a healthcare background. You're at Blue Cross. Yeah. Charlie's private sector claim to fame is rescuing Harvard Pilgrim.
Could be a battle between Blue Cross and Harvard Pilgrim.
Isn't that strange?
From virtual bankruptcy. How would you rate the job that the likely Republican nominee did when he was at Harvard Pilgrim?
You know, he's going to have to speak. First of all, I've known Charlie for 20 years. But Charlie was also there when it actually went into the hole. So the mythology about how he saved it from bankruptcy is interesting, since he was kind of on deck when it got into its big problem. I wouldn't blame that all on him, but he was there. And then essentially the state got him out of the problem. Essentially they revalued the real estate, and Harvard Pilgrim raised its rates very aggressively for years, and that started to get it back. So a lot of help from a lot of people, including the state, was how that happened.
Do people ask you for a quick diagnosis on the campaign trail?
Yeah, all the time. I have to say, all the time.
I bet they do.
This new jobs. Yeah. I'm running for jobs primarily. This new jobs thing is interesting, but I have a spot on my arm. I would like to say, though,
what?
The main reason I'm running is I run a global business. Right now, we have 15,000 employees in 50 countries. I'm responsible for about 11,000 of them and the P&L. I have a global workforce. I work in the global economy every day. This is what we need to do in the state. We need to bring new industries here. And I know that we can do it because I know how my own company with me works with other university systems in other countries. And we can do a lot more here to create the middle skills, the strategic, it's the middle management skills, the middle level of engineering skills. And we can bring a lot of new industries here. And that's what's going to bring back the gateway cities. That's really the focus of my campaign.
How do you rate Deval Patrick's, what is it now, 6.5 years? How do you rate the Patrick administration?
I think he was a very good governor in an incredibly difficult time. I mean, this recession, let's not forget, was devastating, and state governments are exquisitely sensitive to recessions. Revenues go way down, need goes way up. I think he got us through a very tough time.
Joe Avalone, what's your website?
AvaloneForGovernor.com.
And before you leave us, what's the one thing, since you are just getting introduced, what's the one most important thing people need to know about you as they begin to consider you as one of the 4, 5, 6 for the Democratic nomination? What's the single most important thing?
I've created thousands of jobs over 30 years. I can bring new jobs to Massachusetts.
Joe,
that's
Avalone,
a big thing.
It's a pleasure.
We all
thanks
want new
so much
jobs in Massachusetts.
For coming
Thank
in. We assume
much.
We'll see a lot during this campaign.
I hope so. Invite me back. I'd love to be here.
We'd love to have you back. Joe Avalone, Democratic candidate for governor of Massachusetts. Thank
okay.
you, Joe.
Okay.
Yeah,
and
thank
to
you
learn,
guys.
As you guys just said, but I'll repeat it for anybody who didn't hear it the first time around, if you want to know more about Joe's campaign, go to AvaloneForGovernor.com, and it's A-V-A-L-L-O-N.
A-V-E.
A-V-E. Oh, my God. All right. You spell it for us. I goofed it up. Spell it for us.
A-V-E-L-L-O-N-E.
That was just a test to see if you're paying
okay.
attention.
Thank you very much. I apologize for that. Thank no, you very no much, Joe, for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you
it.
Very much.
Joe is a candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor. On the phone with us is a candidate for the mayoralty of Boston. He is the Suffolk County District Attorney, Dan Connolly. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thanks, Jim. Happy to be here.
So what's the last day like for you, Dan? Yesterday you were hanging out with the outgoing police commissioner. Today you're on the line for the mayor's job. How are you feeling?
Feel good. Real good. We've been out campaigning all morning, of course, as are all the other candidates, I'm sure. I've been spending most of my time out in West Roxbury and Roslindale, working the voters as they come in, a last-minute pitch as to why I should be one of the two choices, hopefully the first choice, the mayor of Boston.
So what is your last-minute pitch? If you're trying to grab somebody as they head into the polls, District Attorney Connolly, what do you say?
15 seconds is all you have with that voter, Dan.
That's right. You got to pack a punch here.
I've had about 3 or 4 voters say to me that they were undecided when they walked in. This is what I said. Look, with you mentioned Commissioner Davis. With Commissioner Davis's departure within the next 30 to 60 days, as well as the mayor's departure, we've already lost a school superintendent and VRA director who's going with the mayor. We need a proven leader, someone who's independent, who stands up to special interests, who's managed something big, a multi-million dollar state organization that serves the public. And I think I'm well-suited to take over on January 6th and take a very good city. I'm optimistic about our future, but to take it from good to great, I think I'm the best person for that.
Dan, has there been a big moment in this campaign, not big high profile, but one that really stayed with you, that win or lose today, you're going to take home and say, that's why I do this kind of thing? Was there such a moment?
There's just been an accumulation of moments. I've spoken a lot on the campaign trail about how many people I've met. Of course, these are people I never would have met if I didn't enter this race. And overwhelmingly, people are friendly in this city. When I extend my hand, they extend their hand back, and we have an interaction, human relationship for about, you know, whether it's 10 seconds or 5 minutes. There's a lot of really great people in the city in every neighborhood of Boston. And win or lose, I'm going to come away from that experience a better man.
Well, they're just hoping if they're nice to you, you won't prosecute them. Isn't that what it's about, Dan?
No.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. So a lot of the pictures are like, hey, can we take a picture with the next man? So that really enlivens me. Let me say that.
Well, I'm not kidding about this, Dan Conley. A lot of people thought you had the best light blue shirt and red tie on at the Boston Herald debate. You got the best dressed award. So if things work out for you tomorrow, I guess keep that in mind for the next one.
Hey, Dan,
well,
good luck.
Well, you know, I love that in the Herald the next day. So thanks very much, Marjorie.
Okay. Hey, Dan Conley, Suffolk County DA, good luck today, and thanks so much for a couple of minutes. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan Conley.
On the line now, yes.
Yes.
Number six of the, I'd say, 11 candidates for mayor of Boston. I know they're technically 12. Joining us on the phone is John Barrows. Good morning, John. How are you?
Good morning. How are
good afternoon. Doing? Whatever it is. It's good afternoon, but hello to you anyway, John.
No, it is good afternoon. Thanks, Jim.
So, John Barrows, you've excited a lot of people in the city of Boston who didn't even know about you when this race began. What's your pitch to get that one or two spots so you can continue your campaign into the final?
Well, you know, I'm excited. I'm excited about the momentum that's building. People are believing in their vote. They're believing in what they can do to be a part of creating a new Boston. And a new candidate who hasn't been a politician, who's got fresh ideas, who's got a vision, who has a demonstrated leadership track record that has been inclusive, participatory, that has helped to transform a section of Boston that was very difficult to work in, a section of Boston where we've used municipal powers, powers like eminent domain, which is only held by the BRA, and the only candidate that can say that I've managed that process effectively and used that to remove blight, use municipal planning powers to help build up a neighborhood, supporting small businesses, engaging young people, engaging elders, making it work where we have decreased crime in that area because we've designed for safety. And that's why people should vote for me. They should vote for me because I've done it. I've increased affordable housing under the guise of development without displacement and make all income levels can continue to live in that part of Boston. If that's the Boston you want, then I'm your candidate. If you want a candidate that's worked to help turn around schools, I was there with Governor Patrick when we stood together, and he announced that Orchard Garden was going from a level 4 school to a level 1 school. And it was a real proud moment because we worked really hard to make sure that the children in that neighborhood, the children in that school were getting a top-notch education, and we did it. And we can do that in every school if we focus, invest, and create the autonomies that we need at the school levels. Hey, and I'm excited.
Hey, John, one of the disappointments of this campaign for me and Marjorie is you did not bring us food from your restaurant, which you promised. How has this been? I'm serious. How has this been for the business at your restaurant that you're a candidate for mayor of the city of Boston? Has it helped?
Yeah, that's a great question. I got to ask the guys. I
don't have
too
my pulse
on it, but hopefully it helped. I tried to promote it everywhere I went.
Hey, one last thing, John Barrows. You got a brand new baby. You getting any sleep? Are you up all night, all day in the campaign trail, and up all night with the new baby?
Up all night, all day. We've got to get up at least 2 hours, every 2-3 hours to feed the baby. So I'm averaging maybe 4 hours a night here.
I'm sorry, John
Barrows. Carry that kid to the polls. Hey, John Barrows, good luck, and thanks so much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate the time, guys.
Now joining us on the phone is yet another candidate for mayor of the city of Boston. She is Charlotte Goler Ritchie, former employee of the governor and the mayor. Charlotte, thanks so much for calling in.
Happy to be on the line, Jim and Marjorie and Callie.
Hey, Charlotte, thanks for calling in. Callie just left. I think she went to the ladies' room. But Jim and I, are
still tell her
here.
You said hello.
We're still here. So Charlotte, you know, you have risen up in the polls. The Herald poll a couple of weeks ago had you like within shouting distance of the leader, John Conley. What's your pitch to get people to put you over the top today? What are you telling people as they're going into the polls?
Well, I mean, I think at this point it's really about getting them out of their houses. We know who's out there, who is already supporting us.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know that it's really a big selling sort of pitch. It's really just making sure that they have rides, that they need rides, that they know where their polling place is, that we're, you know, able to do what we can to facilitate their getting to the polls. You know, I've had maybe just this morning, maybe a couple of people who I needed to persuade. And sure, you know, I told them, I reminded them that I had a track record in government, reminded them that I do have some big ideas for what I'd like to do for the city if I am elected. You know, so we did talk through some of that. But it really hasn't been twisting arms. It's been about just reminding people, need you out there. Today is important. You got to vote.
You know, Charlotte, we're talking to Charlotte Gullah-Ritchie. There are a handful of candidates, or a couple of candidates, who have never run for elective office. There are candidates who are currently in office, and there are people like you, state rep ages ago, and then you went to work, as I say, for Deval Patrick, Tom Menino. What's it like, honestly, returning to what is a really, I think, a really difficult way to get a job, namely asking the voters? What's that been like for you after a decade or more not doing it?
Well, it's not familiar territory, right? I have been in a situation because I've run for office three times myself, and I've campaigned for other candidates over the years. So campaigning is not hard for me to do. It's just that I did not have an organization in place. I did not have a ready war chest that I could tap into to run. So there was a little bit of catch-up, right? But because I have been, I know the world of campaigning, I kind of knew how to pull it together fairly quickly, if you think about the time that I've been in this race. And so that's why I think I've been able to rise in the polls, because we could pull an organization together, get the people that we needed on board, and make this thing happen.
Hey, Charlotte, we wish you luck. Charlotte Gullah-Ritchie, we really appreciate your spending a few minutes with us today.
Hey, good luck today, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So far, we've spoken to Charlotte Gullah-Ritchie, John Connolly, Rob Kinsella, Felix Arroyo, Bill Wolczak, Dan Connolly, and John Barros. We have a few more. We've invited all the candidates to give us their final pitch today. We're going to continue to take their calls and yours at 877-301-8970. But while we're waiting to hear from the remainder of your candidates, we have a little surprise for you.
Garen Daly is going to be with us. He's going to talk about mayors in the movies. Can you think of any? I can only think of one, but Garen is going to fill us in. That's coming up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Each day, All Things Considered brings you unparalleled insight into the latest news. We interview experts who have deep knowledge on topics of the day, who have the skills to explain. We unravel complex issues that sometimes seem too hard to grasp. I'm Melissa Block. Join us every afternoon for All Things Considered from NPR News. Your appointment with excellence.
This afternoon at 4, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Subaru of New England, offering the all-new redesigned Subaru Forester with symmetrical all-wheel drive. More information available online at SubaruofNewEngland.com. And the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit, closing soon. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More at MOS.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie. And this is what happens when Beantown politics meets Tinseltown.
What would you consider the greatest spectator sport in the country today? Would you say it was baseball, basketball, football?
Oh, I think basketball is the largest paid attendance.
It's politics. That's right. Politics.
One of my favorite movies, Spencer Tracy is Mayor Frank Skeffington in The Last Hurrah. Here with us in studio to talk about Mayor Skeffington and other movie mayors is film critic Garen Daly. Hey there, Garen.
Hi, guys.
Now, before we get into the movies, by the way, we'll continue to take your calls at 877-301-8970. And we have a couple mayoral candidates yet to call in. We will take their calls in and out of Garen. So, Last Hurrah is the best mayor movie
without
ever.
A doubt.
Yes, without a close
without,
second.
Without a doubt.
Tell
without
people
doubt.
The quick story.
Quick story is it's based on Michael Curley. It's about an aging mayor in an urban area, assuming Boston, who is on his final campaign. He thinks he's going to win, but he loses because of television and the new emerging media. And it's a great movie. It starts
50s, yes,
1950s. 1958. Yeah. John Ford directed it, and Spencer Tracy at his best.
Can we hear a little bit more of this? I know we heard a little bit. Here's a little. This is a fabulous book and a spectacular movie. Here it is.
It's my guess that the old-fashioned political campaign in a few years will be as extinct as the dodo. It'll all be TV and radio. It'll all be streamlined and nice and easy. Well, mind you, I use the TV and the radio sometimes. But I also get out into the wards. I speak in fight arenas, armories, street corners, anywhere where I can gather a crowd. I even kiss babies. That's the way I've always done it. And I must say, it's usually paid off. But there's no use kidding myself about it. It's on its way out.
Not only is he brilliant, how do you like him saying, it's going to be all TV already? Which, talk about prescient, huh?
Well, you know what else was interesting when he said this in the last hurrah, the great Edward O'Connor book? He talked about politics as being the great American spectator sport.
Yeah.
And you wonder today, when we're wondering if people either going to or even going to bother to go vote in Boston, if that's even true anymore.
Well,
I don't know.
I think that there's so much about that movie and what was going on that is so resonant today. When you look at Frank Skeffington and you look at Mayor Menino, you just see kind of the same thing. He's so good at creating a political machine that really worked the wards.
Yeah. But you don't have that kind of turnout anymore. I mean, maybe we'll get it in parts of West Roxbury. I mean, somebody just emailed before and said that they were in their ward and they had almost nobody there where they waited 2 hours when they're going for the presidential race. So you wonder. I mean, people may be into watching politics nationally on television, but I just don't know if people that are that engaged locally anymore. And I don't get it. They used to have that big rally in Dorchester.
Oh, they do.
But it's nothing like it was.
Maybe this is the rally, for those who don't know, in Dorchester, where every candidate, Republican, Democrat, for every office, particularly if it's on a day when there's a general election, a mayor election, city council election. I actually spoke there once when I had a ballot campaign. It is so exciting. The place is packed. It is sort of old time. It's old time politics. And that's why I love the last three. It really captures, in my estimation, exactly what politics was.
You know, but I want to go back to what you were just talking about, Marjorie. I think one of the reasons that we don't have that excitement for mayors is our media doesn't treat them very well. When you look at the breadth of the movies out there, mayors are depicted as either corrupt, vain, vote grabbers. They never talk about serious issues within a city that has to grapple with either a melting pot or, you know, racism or police issues. It's never that. All the mayors in just about every single film that I know of, they are either stupid, vain, or corrupt.
Okay, like what?
Like what? All right, take the latest movie that came out in 2013, Broken City. Russell Crowe plays a mayor who is manipulating Mark Wahlberg to go after his wife and make some money. Another one, Jaws, a perfect example.
Jaws?
Jaws. Think about it.
I thought he was a selectman.
No, he was the mayor. He was the mayor of that city. But think about it. He wears abysmal clothing.
He does. That seersucker deal.
It's horrible. Yeah. Horrible. And he's always concerned about nothing more than making sure everyone comes here. Safety, forget about
That's
it.
Right.
You know, and he's also the kind of the comic relief to Bruce the shark.
That's my kind of movie. His name in the movie is Mayor Vaughn. Here's a little bit from Jaws.
A shark is attracted to the exact kind of splashing and activity that occurs whenever human beings go in swimming. You cannot avoid it.
If you open the beaches on the 4th of July, it's like ringing the dinner bell, for Christ's sake.
Look, we depend on the summer people here for our very lives.
You are not going
and
to have
you
a summer
close those
unless
beaches,
you deal with this
finished.
Problem. We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark.
You are familiar with our problems.
I think that I am familiar with the fact that you are going to ignore this particular problem until it swims up and bites you on the ass.
For Christ's sake, tomorrow's the 4th of July, and we will be open for business. It's going to be one of the best summers we've ever had.
I love the line when Richard Dreyfuss says, if you open these beaches on July 4th, it's like ringing the dinner bell. I have a feeling this guy wouldn't open the beaches on July 4th if there were sharks in Boston Harbor. Joining us on the phone is state representative and candidate for mayor, Marty Walsh. Good morning, Representative. Good afternoon.
How are you? Thank you for having me on the radio today.
Well, thank you for calling, Representative Walsh. You know, Garen Daly just said that one of the problems for mayors, you know, maybe where there isn't such a big, huge turnout at the polls today is because guys like you or everybody that's running for mayor, they don't get the respect they used to when Frank Skeffington was mayor in the last hurrah. What do you think about that?
I mean, it's definitely a different world in politics. I've noticed it in my 16 years in the legislature. You know, even amongst each other, the way we treat each other up on Beacon Hill or in politics in general, you see what's going on in Washington. It's not to that degree here, but people get turned off by it.
Yeah.
And I think this mayor's race, to some degree, has changed that whole culture because we all worked well together. We got along. I mean, we might have had a little few moments of testiness during the race, but I think we all carried ourselves very respectfully, and we all genuinely looked at each other.
Hey, Marty, I think I heard you say the other day, and please, I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong, that when you were elected to the state legislature for the first time, didn't you like drive up to the state house in the middle of the night or something because you couldn't?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was you. I love that quote. So what's it like today? I mean, you have no idea what's going to happen in 6.5 hours. Obviously, you're hoping for the best. You've been in the top four in the polls. What's it like in your city being this close to being in a final to run it?
It's remarkable. I mean, I haven't been nervous the whole campaign, and I saw a few people holding signs for me today, and it really hit me. I was, you know, not butterflies, but I was just overwhelmed to some degree. It's been somewhat emotional for me today.
Mm-hmm.
My father's not here with me today to experience this. It's gratifying. It's a whole bunch of different words. It's hard to put it in one word, but, you know, I've enjoyed this campaign. I've enjoyed going around the city of Boston and meeting people. And today it's kind of like just all the emotions of the last 4 months have been kind of just stirring in my body.
So when can you relax? I mean, I guess you can't relax today. That's
November
the wrong
6th.
Word. Okay. But what do you do from now until the polls close? Do you have to go right till 8 o'clock or can you sit down and have a cup of coffee at 6 o'clock or what's your deal?
Yeah, I've had about. I mean, in the campaign, I've realized I haven't really drank that much coffee in the campaign. Surprisingly, I've had about 4 cups of coffee today. It's like an expecting parent.
Yeah,
you know, you're just walking around waiting for something to happen. Except this time, you kind of know when the delivery's coming. You know, going out, still meeting voters and talking to people. I'm still doing that. You know, preparing for tonight. Obviously, you know, you have to prepare your remarks for tonight. Either way, so. I've done a little bit of that. Reflect on the campaign in itself. You know, I have no regrets at all in the campaign, how my campaign has been run or what I've done as a candidate or the thousands of volunteers that I have. I don't regret any of that. So it's kind of a little bit of everything. You know, normally on a day like today, and Jim can appreciate this, I would be running a field for somebody and you know, working a poll all day and tracking people down. This is a completely different piece.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not running my field. I'm, you know, the press is doing the press stuff. Everyone's doing their thing. So I'm kind of like, I think as a candidate, we're all kind of, we actually probably should have gone to dinner or gone to movies or something, all candidates.
Hey, Marty, go have a cup of coffee. Marjorie will pay for it. Is that a deal?
That sounds good.
Hey, Marty, Walsh.
What? I'm sorry.
Maybe I'll meet you after your show. We'll have some coffee.
Okay.
Stay represented by Marty Walsh. Good
Marty
luck tonight,
Walsh.
Marty. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for calling, and good luck in the race. We have another candidate
yeah, we
on
do.
Line as well, too.
Joining us on the phone is a city councilor. He's the 8th of the candidates, or is he 9th? 9th, kind enough to call us today. City Councilor Mike Gross. Hello there, city councilor.
Hi, how are you both doing?
Excellent.
Oh, we're doing very well. So, Mike, what I just asked this to Marty Walsh. What do you do today? Do you run from poll to poll from now until 8 o'clock, or do you get any downtime, or what's your deal from now until the polls close?
Yeah, we're pretty much running from poll to poll, and I guess running is the operative word because I haven't gone anywhere where people haven't started reciting this now kind of, you know, I don't know, I want to say famous, but this now well-known commercial that
of yours,
it's memorable.
Yeah, it's memorable, and I think it's given people a reason to, I don't know, to smile, to look at a 12 candidate race and see, you know, maybe one person breaks through enough so someone can actually go online, you know, read my plan, find out more about what I'm about, and it's been a good welcome across the city. I'm definitely moving around this city. I just left Holy Name, which was, you know, the world famous, world renowned Holy Name Church, where you do not go, you do not pass, you go directly to if you want to run for mayor in this city, if you want to run for office in this state. It's Holy Name Rotary, it's Holy Name Church. It was my first experience at Holy Name, and it was a great welcome, good support. There were some Mike Ross supporters, believe it or not, walking into the heart of West Roxbury.
There you go.
pulling the Mike Ross a lever, or checking the box, rather. And, you know, I've spent some time at Roche Brothers in West Roxbury, and there's a lot of support. The only difference is that when they say they're supporting me, they kind of do the whisper thing, right? Like, they're supporting you, Mike, you know, because it is an extremely political community. And, you know, you have someone, you know, political yard sign in your front yard, whether you're supporting them or not. In our case, we have a couple people like that. So we feel pretty good across the city. I just think that there is a different demographic as well as a traditional demographic. I think we're appealing a little bit of both. And hopefully, in the end, it will make the difference. I checked in with my campaign team, who's terrific, who really just amazing people, working very hard. I love them all. They're excellent. And they're telling me that we're up in places where we need to be up. We're up in Beacon Hill. We're up in the South End. And we're up in Mission Hill. That's really good news for us. It's not great news that citywide is kind of down, but it is great news that where we're up in those three communities.
Hey, Mike Ross, we wish you a lot of luck. Good luck tonight, and thanks so much for taking a couple of minutes to give us a buzz.
Thank you, Mike, for calling.
Appreciate it very much.
And
thanks.
Good luck. Good luck to you.
City Council Michael Ross, that makes nine of the candidates, yep, have been kind enough to give us a couple of minutes. We're joined in studio by Garen Daly. We're talking about mayoral movies. We'll take your calls at 877-301-8970. We still haven't heard from Clemens, Yancey, and Wyatt, and we are encouraging them to call 877-301-8970 as well. But I'm going to use my own prerogative because I love the bite so much. We're talking about mayors. Let's hear Mayor Vaughn one more time with Richard Dreyfuss in Jaws. This is a great bite.
A shark is attracted to the exact kind of splashing and activity that occurs whenever human beings go in swimming. You cannot avoid it.
If you open the beaches on the 4th of July, it's like ringing the dinner bell, for Christ's
sake. Look, we depend on the summer people here for our very lives.
You are not going to have a summer unless you deal with this problem. We're not only going to have to close the beach, we're going to have to hire somebody to kill the shark.
You are familiar with our problems.
I think that I am familiar with the fact that you are going to ignore this particular problem until it swims up and bites you on the ass.
For Christ's sake, tomorrow's the 4th of July, and we will be open for business. It's going to be one of the best summers we've ever had.
That was a great, great, great clip. So we talked about Jaws, which I wouldn't have thought of, even though it's a perfect image of a one of those corrupt mayors you're talking about, or at least the mayor only worried about the bottom line. We talked about The Last Hurrah, one of the best movies, not just political movies ever. What's number three on the mayoral movie list, Garen Daly?
I would have to go with Milk. Sean Penn doing Milk.
Yes.
And Victor Garber.
That was a great movie.
Yep. We should tell, most people know the story. What's the story of Harvey Milk, obviously, in San Francisco?
Harvey Milk was the first gay man to be elected for office in California, and he had a relationship with a man by Dan White, and he also had a strong relationship with the Mayor Moscone. And this is a true story. Dan White ended up going off the deep end and killing both Milk and Moscone. And it was a very tragic story. So they made a movie about it, directed by Gus Van Sant. It came out in 2008, and Sean Penn won an Oscar for his portrayal.
And by the way, one of the reasons why Dianne Feinstein is such a powerful advocate for gun control, and one of the most powerful, is she became the mayor of San Francisco right after that.
And that case also launched the now infamous Twinkie defense. Remember that?
Yes, I remember that. Yeah. I wasn't going to bring that up. I mean, there's so many people who love the fact that Twinkies have come back.
Yeah, well, that was Dan White. That was one of the claims, I think, that the Twinkies made me do it kind of deal.
Now, I am told there is a movie, and I have to say that I had never heard of this before. Is it called Welcome to Mooseport? Is that the – and that's about a mayor?
Yes, it's actually about an ex-president and a mayor.
It's Gene Hackman, right?
I know. And first of all, when I look at this and I go, what is Gene Hackman doing in this film?
And Welcome to Mooseport,
But really, it's a Ray Romano film. And so when Ray Romano was at his height, it was Ray Romano against Gene Hackman with Maura Tierney, Hyde Park Girl. And it's a story about this ex-president who served two terms going to a small town in Maine, Mooseport,
Maine.
And he decides to run for mayor. And this local carpenter guy, Ray Romano, decides to challenge him. And it becomes a national issue where the two of them are going back and forth. But it's really all about romance.
Here's a little piece of Welcome to Mooseport.
Is this town small enough?
Mr. President, I'm running for the mayor of Mooseport.
Are you telling me that I'm running for mayor against the man installing my toilet?
For the both of them.
What just happened?
You're running against the president.
And your girlfriend's dating him.
Let's bury this guy. Time to take your gloves off.
I'm embarrassed to say I laughed. Is it funny?
It's okay. Diverting. I mean, look, there are a lot of films that you get five or six decent laughs out of. Whether it's funny or not, that's a whole other story. I would say it's diverting. I mean, anytime you see Gene Hackman.
Yeah, he's always good.
He's always great. Good. He's good. You know, I'm sorry he's retired now, but I would love to see more of him. But it's not a great movie.
Our number is 877-301-8970. If you have a favorite mayoral movie, even if you wouldn't have thought of it as a mayoral movie, like Jaws, for example, give us a buzz. And also on our final 12, 13, 14 minutes, if you have voted today in Boston, you want to give us a sense of what it was like at the polls. David Bernstein reported the turnout citywide, as of, I believe, noon, was 10.5%, which is a little troubling to me. The projection from the Secretary of State, who does such things, is of 368,000 registered voters in Boston. He was expecting somewhere in the neighborhood of 110,000 to 125,000 to turn out. The high end of that is only 34%, which I think is pretty pathetic in a field with qualified people. And if you've decided not to vote today, if you're part of the 60-some percent who are registered in Boston but have decided that this is not your cup of tea, we would love to hear from you at 877-301-8970.
And there's also the email address, WGBH. Ooh, shoot, what's the email address?
I'm not telling you.
I forget the email address. BPR@WGBH.org. Yeah. That's correct. Okay, BPR@WGBH.org. Scott just emailed, and he said he thinks the low turnout is because it's a primary. That other than Walczak, who's against the casino, and Conley, who's all about schools, there are not that many differences among the candidates. That's his position anyway, and he says there'll be a big turnout at the final.
Well, that may be the case, but it's preliminary with 12 people, and they're... Mm-hmm.
Well, he thinks most of the candidates are okay.
Well, it's good. Is he voting or is he not? Is he from Boston?
He did not say whether he was voting or not. That was his analysis of why the turnout is low.
877-301-8970. Garen Dale, give us one more great mayoral movie that people should check out when they're in the mayoral spirit between now and November 5th.
I think they should go to Ghostbusters.
There's a mayor in
Ghostbusters? I forgot. Who's the mayor? I forgot the scene.
The guy is David Margolis. It's a scene where the Ghostbusters have been busted and they're being brought into the mayor's office.
We have the scene. Stop right where you are. You can describe it afterwards, because here is that scene.
The Ghostbusters are here, Mr. Mayor.
The Ghostbusters. Okay, the Ghostbusters. Hey, where's this Peck?
I am Walter Peck, sir, and I'm prepared to make a full report. These men are consummate snowball artists. They use sense and nerve gases to induce hallucinations. People think they're seeing ghosts.
Well, you could believe Mr. Pecker, or you could accept the fact that this city is headed for a disaster of biblical proportion.
What do you mean, biblical?
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Enough, I get the point. What if you're wrong?
If I'm wrong, nothing happens. We go to jail. But if I'm right, and we can stop this thing, you will have saved the lives of millions of registered voters.
You know, I was really depressed about turnout, and now I'm happy because these are great scenes.
That was pretty good.
So, Garen, does Ghostbusters hold up? I mean, one of the problems with movies that I totally love, is it still great now?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
It really is?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there are parts of it that may be a little dated from moment to moment, but still, it's a great... I mean, Bill Murray is just so good in it. Sigourney Weaver is good.
Sigourney Weaver
is terrific. And the little nerdy guy in Ghostbusters? The guy that's always getting
Ramis,
chased around.
Rick Moranis.
Thank you, John Parker, one of our colleagues.
He's terrific, too.
And how many kids, you know, these days talk about who is the Keymaster and Gozer and all those things? It now resonates throughout the culture.
Okay, we have calls. Now, interesting, the show, even though we're both bemoaning the fact that turnout seems not to be that high, everybody's interested in calling about mayoral movies, so let's talk about them for a minute. Paul from Milton, you are next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Margery and Garen Daly. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, for better or worse, we don't have a mayor in Milton. So,
what do you have? A town manager?
We have three selectmen.
Selectmen.
Okay.
And a town administrator.
Okay, fine. So,
what's your movie,
Paul?
The Music Man. Paul Ford playing the mayor.
Oh, yes. Good choice.
And Hermione Gingold as his wife, which was a good counterpoint. Two buffoons.
Music Man was a pretty great movie, too.
What was he the mayor of?
River City,
of course, because that's part of the song.
That's right. Yes, that's a great one, Paul. Thank you.
And Robert Preston, by the way, was from Brookline.
Is that true?
He was?
Yeah.
God, how did we miss that?
He went to high school with Mike Wallace. Is that the next thing you're going to tell us?
I don't know. know. They might be. They were probably about the same age.
I know that. Check it out and call us back. Paul from Milton, thank you so much for the call. How'd you forget Music Man on your list, Mr. Movie Guy?
You know, I'm allowed a mistake or two, you know?
we have an email. Godzilla, played by Matthew Broderick, is a spoof of Siskel and Ebert, the movie critics. Do you know about this?
I saw that movie of Godzilla. It's not very good, but he was not a mayor. I mean, there's always a mayor in city things.
Know.
And they're usually...
Emailer
when
said so.
Again, just like what Paul was talking about with the
Music Man. Yeah.
The mayor is depicted as a buffoon. He's over the top. He's not someone of substance.
You know, one of the great ideas, maybe one of these candidates said, you know what would have been a great fundraiser for one of these candidates is to show something like The Last Hurrah. Now, I know there's an underside to Spencer Tracy and Frank Skeffington in that, too. But what a great event in a mayoral campaign to invite 1,000 of your best friends to some theater and do a little Last Hurrah. In any case, Jeff, you're in Rhode Island. You're apparently not voting today in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up, Jeff?
Hey, I just wanted to chime in with my favorite mayoral movie.
What's that?
And it is Street Fight, which is more of a documentary, but it is Cory Booker and his race for the Newark mayoral race.
What's the name of it again?
Street Fight.
Street Fight. And by the way, Deval Patrick, who will be with us tomorrow, I believe, is in New Jersey today campaigning for Cory Booker for the United States Senate. I never heard of that.
Neither have I.
Yeah, if you've never heard of it, you absolutely have to see it. It is one of the best movies I've ever seen.
Really?
Because it actually started, they started filming it as just a document, the mayoral race. But what happened was there was actually so much corruption going on with Cory Booker's opponent that they wanted nothing to do with the filming. They actually tried to shut down filming multiple times. So it ended up being like this great story of Cory Booker, and he actually ends up losing that race, but then comes back the next time and wins it.
Oh, that sounds so. What's it called? One more time.
Street Fight.
Street Fight.
Street Fight.
We'll check it out.
Fight.
Well, he's a pretty impressive guy. Yeah,
very charismatic guy, too.
Very,
Jeff, thank
very
you for the call.
Guy.
You ever hear of that one, Garandino?
I haven't heard it, but I wrote it down because I want to see it.
Yeah, so do I. And by the way, he's running for the United States Senate seat. What was the name of the guy? Was it Frank Lautenberg, who I believe died in his 90s? Am I right about that? I hope I didn't make a mistake.
Regardless, he's from New Jersey.
I know he's from New Jersey. I hope I didn't commit him to an early death.
That he's
I hope
still
I'm
with
not
us?
Wrong.
I'm embarrassed to say I'm not sure if he's still with us or not, Jim.
Our number is 877-301-8970. I guess we're taking calls divided between the real and the fictional. The real is that we have preliminary election day in Boston. If you're voting or not voting and you're a Bostonian, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have a nominee for the best mayoral movie, give us a buzz as well. Garen Daly is with us.
Gina from Framingham. What do you think, Gina?
I was thinking Dirty Harry, David Cole. He's like the vigilante. I had to cover it up.
Hey, Gina, we got to put you on hold a second. It's a horrible connection. We all heard every other word.
I think she said the mayor and Dirty Harry.
Do you know anything about that?
Oh, yes, the mayor and Dirty Harry. Yeah. And again, there's another example of where you're using a drama with Clint Eastwood, and the mayor has a completely different agenda than what is right and what is correct.
Okay, so if I went to Dirty Harry with you years ago, and at the end, when we shook hands and said goodbye, Garen, I said, by the way, in 40 years, Clint Eastwood is going to be one of the most talented, great directors in America. What would your response have been?
I probably would have been a little bit not believing you. But then again, you have to understand what the name of Clint Eastwood's production company is called.
What is it?
It's called Mal Paso, which is Bad Move. And it goes to the fact that he left the United States to go make Spaghetti Westerns,
I know
and
that.
And everyone was making fun of him, but it turned out to be a great career move. And at that point, I would have probably said, you know what? Clint Eastwood is one of the smartest guys running a career in Hollywood. So, yes, I probably would have been surprised, but I wouldn't have been that surprised.
And the Spaghetti Westerns, what was the name of the television show? Rawhide, was that
Rawhide,
what it was?
Yeah.
It was sort of this B-level, I mean, it was fairly popular television show.
Right.
Then he does the Spaghetti Westerns. Then he comes back as Dirty Harry. And then, lo and behold, he is this brilliant director in his 80s, by the way,
which gives
everybody hope for the future.
You know, I just happen when I'm...
And by the way, he was the mayor of Carmel,
California,
speaking of mayors.
Lots of
times
I'm in the kitchen cooking on a Sunday afternoon, Saturday afternoon. I watch, like, old movies, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, with Clint Eastwood was on the other day. It was unbelievable. You know what else was on the other day that was unbelievable? It was on this station, actually, WGBH. I was talking about it with our producer, Chelsea, before. Splendor in the Grass with Warren Beatty when he was about 22. And you can understand why he was a Hollywood heartthrob. Oh, my
Marjorie
God.
Marjorie would vote for him for anything.
Oh, my. Well, either one of them. Clint or Warren. They're both, you know, easy on the eyes.
Okay, we have a guy calling from East Boston who's calling about a movie. But before you talk about a movie, Dave, did you vote today?
No, I didn't, but I plan on doing that after work.
Great. Who are you voting for?
John Connolly.
Okay. And why?
He's for improving the neighborhood of East Boston. He's against the casino. He's going after the absentee landlords and the... in the neighborhood, just a number of different.
Okay.
You know,
okay. Thank you.
Okay. I'm
so
not sure we agree on all the facts
there.
What's a movie?
It's actually not a movie. It was a TV show on Starz, and it was called Boss, starring Kelsey Grammer.
Oh, Kelsey
Grammer. Kelsey Grammer, obviously.
He's great in anything.
Yeah.
Wait a second. And as Boss, is he the mayor in this television show?
Yes. He's the mayor of Chicago. It's going through mental problems, dementia, and he's trying to hold on to power and, you know, keep things going in the city.
Is it a comedy or a drama? I mean, I'm serious.
It's a drama.
It is with Kelsey Grammer. Wow. Boss is the name. Dave, thanks. It's a rotten connection on your phone, too. Thank you so much for the call. He's going out to vote, which makes me happy.
Yeah, he is going out to vote. I think John Connolly is pro-casino.
No, it was unclear to me whether he meant Dan or John. And, you know, by the way, a lot of us made fun of the Connolly issue earlier on. The Herald, for example, endorsed Connolly and Connolly.
Right.
And there are some, I'm sure, that each of them
were. One is the district attorney, Connelly. One is the city councilor, that's Connolly. But people do, they're pronounced the same, so you do confuse them. I would be one of those people in the poll who couldn't tell which was which.
No, you wouldn't. Jim, you're in Boston. You're on with Marjorie Egan, Jim Browdy, and Garen Daly. We're talking about mayoral movies and the mayoral race. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for the call. Maybe a little obvious, but I still love Sean Penn and Milk.
He was great.
Yeah.
He was great.
And I, for the documentary side, I have to say the Ed Koch film, if you haven't seen it, it's pretty phenomenal.
That's a good film.
And about to vote right now.
Oh, you are? Who are you voting for?
I typically keep it a secret, but I was a Connolly guy, but I think I might be switching.
Why are you switching?
I just don't find him genuine.
And when you say Connolly, just so we were...
Is it Dan, the DA, or... city councilor?
City councilor.
Okay.
So who might you switch to, Jim? This is interesting. Who might you switch to?
I think I'm trying to – I want a candidate that represents all the people in Boston.
And who might that be?
I don't mean for it to sound racist, but it's I think I'm tired of seeing white men run the city.
No,
really? So who's your non-white candidate?
That's what I'll say for now.
Okay, Jim, thank you.
Oh, Jim, left us hanging there.
Thank you
left
so much.
Left us hanging.
For the call. And Garen Daly, speaking of thank you.
Well, you know, there's one last film that I want to bring up.
Yeah.
And that is Preston Sturges' acerbic comedy called The Great McGinty, where...
That was like 80 years ago, right?
It's like 1940.
Okay.
But it's all about a guy who votes once and votes often.
Hey, it's the best of politics. Garen Daly, it's great to see you, and we'll see you again soon.
My pleasure.
Now, by the way, we want to thank a bunch of candidates. 9 candidates called in. Ross, Walczak, Goler, Ritchie, Connolly, Consalvo, Arroyo. I missed one, did I not? Barros and... Charlotte Goler-Ritchie. Thank all 9 of them for sharing a couple of minutes of their big day with us.
And thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We've got Governor Deval Patrick here. He's going to join us from 1 to 2 o'clock. We're also going to go over the mayoral results with Peter Kansas and Adam Riley. It's going to be very exciting because tomorrow we're going to know who are the 2 people who are going to fight it out to become the next mayor of the city of Boston, and that's pretty exciting. We don't have to go to the polls, Jim, because we don't live in Boston.
I want to say, though,
I kind of wish I did.
So do I. And if you're lucky enough to live in Boston, you still have 6 hours and 2 minutes. Use your right to vote. Go do it. We'll see you tomorrow. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio, and thanks again for tuning in.
Instead of asking you to talk about the pain in your foot or the ache in your chest, doctors increasingly want to talk about your story.
This work begins by asking the question, why wouldn't a person with a chronic condition do everything in their power to live long and feel well?
I'm Kai Rizdahl, treating illness a whole new way, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you. And Sullivan Tire and Auto Service, family-owned and operated with over 60 locations across New England. From oil changes to computer diagnostics, their technicians are prepared to maintain your vehicle. Locations at SullivanTire.com. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.